Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 361, I chat with composer John Keane about his new 5.1 channel, Music Blu-ray. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded July 6th, 2017. Episode 361, Surrounded by Music. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week's guest geek is John Keane, a composer, arranger, performer, all-around musical kind of guy. Hey, John, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott, how are you? It's great to be here.
Doing good. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here. Those of you who are tuned in live at live.twit.tv can log into the chat room there or at irc.twit.tv, and you can post questions as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. John, let's start with a little bit of background. You started recording at a very early age, didn't you?
Absolutely. Our family's been in the music industry a very long time. My mother was in the industry. My father started with a label back in the 50s and was a producer. My mother was a performer in the 40s and 50s with her twin sister. They made records for Capitol Records, did USO tours, and my father had the second largest independent label in the States at that time, and he produced artists such as Ritchie Valens, Bobby Fuller, released some early Sam Cooke records. And so he was really at the forefront of when this whole thing started. So we were kind of, born with this music business in our blood.
Yeah. There's a picture of you actually in the studio as a kid that you sent me that I thought was so cool.
Well, let's take a look.
There it is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting story because, we were, my brother and I have two brothers, one that's older, about 7 years older, and my brother Tom, who's a year older, we ended up forming this duo based on my father's past. You know, he had an ear for talent, so he recognized our musical abilities early on, and we kind of, got into it so early, and he took some of his past, and, in my bedroom, he started a little recording studio. And, we must have been 10, 11, 12 years old. I don't know how long ago that photo. I remember that. There was a little 8-track reel-to-reel right there and a TIAC board. And that whole piece right there was manufactured to hold that, as you can tell. It's a pretty slick little setup for back in the day. Mm-hmm. And that was probably, 1975. So I must have been about 10 or 11 years old there. So we were recording from a really, really young age and performed and made records. We were on all the TV shows of the day, Johnny Carson 4 times, Mike Douglas.
Oh, no kidding, remember. Really? Wow.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And the interesting thing about that was we did Mike Douglas, Dinah Shore, Wonderama. Do you remember that one, Scott?
I don't remember that one.
Yeah, that was like a Saturday morning kind of show. But
okay.
So we had made our first record in 76 with 20th Century Records, my brother Tom and I, under the name the Keane Brothers. Mm. So then we were touring and we made another record after that. And so I think by the time we were about 17 and 18, we had made four albums together. So we were prolific and kind of child prodigies at that time. And back then, radio wasn't really open to kids. And we were serious musicians writing serious songs. And it was a different time, so it was considered more of this bubble gum. So you can go back to some of these, I think it's on my Facebook page, where you see like Tiger Beat, and there's all these kind of articles and interviews with the Keen brothers, you know, right along with the stars of the day. So it was an interesting time, and
not very many kids grow up like that.
Well, let me tell you, I mean, entertainment's not a great place for children, but we survived, and I think we've done pretty well. You know, Tom continues to work in the industry, and I've gone on, and so it is interesting. I wouldn't recommend it for kids today, but I kind of liken it. I kind of liken it to this notion that we have today about these what are called trophy kids in sports. I mean, it's completely immersive. I mean, we were practicing 6 hours a day before we went to school, when we came home. And so it was really kind of an immersive kind of experience from the time we were, you know, very young. And we were chained to our instruments for 6 hours a day without food or water. I don't know.
In a way, I mean, today that would be called child abuse.
Yeah. Well, so anyway. Now,
there's a couple of early album art pictures I wanted to show people, too. Just to show that you've been working hard. Look at that, the Keen brothers. This is a Japanese release, I assume.
That's right. Yeah, we did two. The last two records we made together were for the Japanese market, CBS, Sony. And as I said earlier, you know, we had a lot of notoriety, but there weren't a lot of record sales for the Keen brothers. We had our own primetime television show in '76 as well that lasted 4 weeks and.
Four whole weeks in prime time.
Let me tell you, that thing still embarrasses me today. Some of the vignettes and skits on it, it's pretty, it was pretty funny. But yeah, that was more of a kind of rock period. As you can see, we're pretty edgy in those photographs there. So it's been an interesting ride. I'll tell you, it was an interesting beginning and a circuitous path with a, you know, very interesting ride thus far.
You also recorded in a bunch of great studios. There's one of you at Capitol Records.
That's right.
There's a photo here that with a band. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that was kind of the second portion of my career, where I went from the Keen brothers and started as a studio musician. That was 1987, that photo, and there's some great players in that photo. That's an album that we were doing for Richard Marx that I was playing drums on. And you have Michael Omardian, incredible keyboardist. Bruce Geitsch, a great songwriter and guitar player. Nathan East on bass with Richard Marx and David Cole, the producer. Mm. And that was a breakout record of the time. And that's kind of where I ended up, was playing drums on a lot of sessions while still kind of developing my solo career, which songwriting and performing and all this stuff. So that was in tandem. And ultimately I left that studio world to pursue my own kind of career. And that led me into composing for television. Primarily, I'd done some film stuff with songs, but mostly my work has been in television, where I've done over 400 episodes of TV.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, that'll keep you busy.
That's right. It kept me busy. And I have the unique distinction of being the composer that has the, you know, the kind of description of the most amount of, you know, dead body music, because I worked on CSI for 16 years. And let me tell you,
a lot of dead bodies on that show.
I scored a lot of dead bodies, let me tell you. So I think I got the Guinness Book of World Records on that one. So
okay, all right. And you do that mostly from your current studio, which we have a couple pictures of as well. You're also talking to us from there, so we see a little bit of that in the background. But
that's correct.
We also have a couple of photos here to show people of your current studio.
That's right.
There's one, and we're going to get a little bit later, we're going to see a close-up of that big giant synthesizer back there, because that's part of really what we want to focus on today.
That's absolutely
just to give you a sense. Here's another look, and You know, it's amazing how much music technology has evolved since you began in the mid 70s as a kid. You know, I for many years I was the technical editor of Electronic Musician magazine, and I saw this evolution from lots of gear to, I mean, you could almost do everything you want to do within a computer now. I mean, that's a major change.
Absolutely. But I think a lot of people are embracing going back to the analog, you know, the fundamentals. And I kind of liken it to a piano or a guitar or something where, you know, it's hard to improve upon. You know, when you have a large format analog console, there's just the tactile nature of it and the workflow of that I'm much more partial to that than using a mouse, and which I've done for years, and a screen and everything, and it's fantastic what that can offer, and I wouldn't want to give it up. But primarily, I like to work in the analog domain, and I find that it's just easier to achieve the results I'm looking for, and more enjoyable, as well as kind of keeping the workspace more kind of interactive instead of just being at the mouse and clicking and that stuff, which can lead to, as we know, you know, repetitive strain and stuff. At least on a console, you're always, you know, you're at the patch bay, you're moving, you know, it's active. It's kind of an active workspace, which I love too, you know.
What do you think about recording? You mentioned analog, and I was wondering what you think about recording to analog tape as opposed to recording digitally, at least at the very beginning. Ultimately, it's going to end up as digital on a CD or as a file for downloading or on Blu-ray, such as the example we're going to talk about shortly. But many people, some people anyway, prefer to capture the sound initially on analog tape. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think there's a lot of interesting technologies out there that allow you to do that. You know, it's pretty onerous working with a tape machine after having, you know, the digital revolution take place. I mean, obviously the rewind times, you know, tape is definitely can be iffy because there's so few manufacturers and whatnot. And the expedience in which you can work in the digital domain, you know, I think we've all kind of gotten used to that kind of, you know, no rewind times and which has its own issues too, which contributes to fatigue and, you know, sometimes taking a breath, which is what working in the, you know, with an analog tape machine allows you is that rewind time to kind of exhale and gather your thoughts or, you know, kind of reapproach your performance. As far as the sound is concerned, you know, I personally know there's a lot of people that feel like there's a benefit to recording in analog. I'm really happy with the higher sample rates and the higher bit resolution. At this point, it would be hard for me to justify wanting to work and give up the ease of use and the expedience in which I can work in the digital domain. So I thought about it a couple times about bringing in a tape machine, and I certainly have recorded all those pictures that you see there. I mean, I spent years recording on analog tape machines. And the thing I love about it is that you do have to have an incredible amount of skill to be able to capture a take, which is something very different from what's happening in the digital world now. You have to play it all the way through top to bottom because there might not be a chance to punch in because the punch in head or the machine might not be fast enough to, deal with some of the overheads on particularly in drums and whatnot. So that part of it, I really do love the idea that you have to nail it. But I it would be hard to go back to fully committing to recording a project on analog and, giving up what, I've been enjoying about digital for so long.
Yeah. Yeah. Sandman actually wondered, I saw that question in the chat room now, wondered that exact same thing. So you're not normally recording to tape these days. You're just recording to digital at a high resolution.
Right. Absolutely. And that's the only way I record is 9624. I mean, that's where I'm at. And that's what led me to the format that I released the project on was because, I wanted to preserve the integrity of the audio and have it, represented as it is in my studio. And I think that's important. I really believe in high resolution audio and, you know, trying to fight the good fight to elevate the conversation beyond, you know, these lower sample rates and bit rates. And because there's a big difference.
Yeah. Especially between MP3.
Absolutely.
You know, that's definitely a serious degradation in quality. I want to talk a little bit later about high-res audio theoretically, but first I want to start talking a little bit about this project that you've just released, which is very, very cool. It's actually an album of music on Blu-ray. And we've talked about this a couple times on the show. I had Rob Abbey on from Sony. They have their Pure Music Initiative. I've had Mark Waldrop on a number of times talking about high-res audio and surround sound mixing or recordings. And here you are with your Blu-ray, which has just been released and has no name, which I think is kind of interesting.
Right.
It's the nameless, Blu-ray. It has your initials on them. Yeah, and we can see a picture of the cover art here. But it's a very interesting project that in fact you've released on AIX Records, which is Mark Waldrop's label. So tell us a little bit about what your idea was for producing this, why you did it, how you approached it.
Well, initially, it wasn't really a project. It was more kind of some exploration into, you know, that picture of the System 55, the Moog that you saw earlier. And I began to kind of just experiment out of my passion for recording and composing, producing, and playing music. I do that. I just record. I'm constantly recording, writing, making music. And it's a deep passion. And so I began to accumulate these tracks that were in the same kind of vein where the genesis of this music was born out of the Moog System 55. And I had a very good friend come over. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, we actually have a picture of the Moog 55.
Yes.
Which is called Modular Synth, that yes. We should be able to see a better picture of. And interestingly, this is very similar to the Moog that I learned on.
Absolutely.
When I was studying electronic music. And this is the classic, you know, when people think about synthesizers, at least those of us of a certain age, you know, we think about this. We think about Switched On Bach.
Absolutely.
Walter Carlos at the time, now Wendy Carlos, and Patch Chords.
Right.
Keith Emerson was another one, right, who recently passed away, I think, right?
Yes, yeah, he did, sadly.
That was very sad because I was a big fan of his. And you had this huge, giant machine that you could modulate. You could change the sound, manipulate the sound very, very nicely by patching these different modules together. But it still only gives you one note at a time. It's monophonic.
Absolutely. It's like a bass, right? I mean, for the most part, one note at a time.
Yep.
But the thing about it, it's infinitely creative because there's so many variables, and that's the brilliance of what he created here. And so it really inspires one to experiment. And I think that's at the core of that instrument is really, I don't think it got its day in full because shortly after that we got presets, right? And because it was more expeditious to have, you know, to be able to go through presets and technology marches on. But I do believe that there's really a lot of ground to be covered in creating really unique stuff with that instrument as well as others. And that's what I kind of dove into, and that's what created the beginning of this. And as I kind of accrued a bunch of these tracks, I played it for a buddy who thought, you know, hey, you should do something with this. You know, put it out there, see if people are into it, and just make it available because it is, you know, kind of some different stuff. And nobody's crazy enough to do, a 5-1 Blu-ray disc except me and Mark. So, you know, what the heck? It's not like the market's on fire for it. But there's a lot of passion behind it. There's interest in the technology. And, you know, it's just fun. I mean, when you come up with a great patch, or you shape a sound or sculpt a sound, I mean, it's really, it's a satisfying experience for me personally, which is, you know, might be part of my personality disorder or something. I don't know, but it's,
well, it's one of the things that I found so interesting about the project was you conceived it. I mean, okay, so you've been doing a bunch of experimenting. You recorded a bunch of stuff.
Right.
And then you decided, you know what, this could become a project, so to speak.
Right.
But you conceived of it from the beginning to be surround music, 5.1 channels.
Absolutely.
And I'd love to hear what you have, why you went that route from the beginning. Why was it conceived in such a way?
That's interesting. That's a very good question, Scott. And I think that's what led me down the rabbit hole, as it were, because there are so many possibilities with this instrument. And I started to look at the notion of being able to separate, you know, as you're aware, these 960 sequencers on there trigger sounds and pitches, right? And ultimately they go into the oscillators and so what you're able to do is start to isolate these individual outputs and start to put them in locations, which I thought would be a perfect kind of marriage for 5.1 because of this, the 5.1 spectrum. It makes it so much more interesting and immersive than just stereo. So, there's a lot of outputs on there's 8 outputs as a matter of fact. So I really got creative in that way. And 5.1 really facilitated the ability to, make something interesting happen with moving this stuff around. And, it was definitely informing the production aesthetic of the project, because it was like, wow, what if I put, you know, this sound here, this sequence, and then I have the other one kind of in the back, you know, rear surround here. And I started to play with this kind of different positions. And that was kind of an interesting thing I thought that nobody had really quite explored yet. And so I did, and I kept on with it. And then I, you know, once I decided I was going to do something, I kind of looked around, and that's what led me to Mark Waldrep of AIX Records. And he contributed some fantastic visuals, which is one of the other benefits of the Blu-ray platform, is being able to, we decided not to make it just pure audio. We wanted a counterpart, you know, with video, which was, I think, a great call. And as well, we could include a binaural recording with my, you know, as we were talking about earlier, with my binaural head that I...
Oh, yeah, we're going to get to that in a second. Believe me, that's really, really cool.
Yeah. So the whole 5.1 thing is really kind of, it's in concert with the 55. I mean, those two things, I think, were really, I had some curiosity about what I could make happen. And since then, I've been recording a lot of things, and I'm even going further with it. So I'm just, you know, kind of on a tear with this thing and seeing how far I can go with it and what I can create with it, which is, it's interesting to me. So.
Yeah. Well, we've actually got, I'd love to play a little bit from the album, and I have to warn people, not warn, just alert, and let you know that it's not going to be in 5.1 because this is, you know, we just do stereo audio on these, all the TWiT podcasts, but still in all, it should give you some idea of what it is that we're talking about. And one of the interesting, we'll show a YouTube video, a little bit of YouTube video,
okay,
which has the video as well. You put some video on it. I want to ask you a little bit more about that after we've taken a little listen. So, Josh, if you can pull up that YouTube video and give it a spin for a couple minutes. This is what you call a trailer with snippets, little pieces of the first couple songs.
Thank you.
Yeah, man. Now, this YouTube video goes on for like 9 minutes, so we're not going to play the whole thing, but you can certainly find it and listen to these snippets of, I think there are 9 tracks on the Blu-ray. Is that right?
I believe so.
9 or 10, something like
that. Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Absolutely. Anyway, a couple people in the chat room have made some interesting comments. One is comparing this to like Morton Subotnick. He had a huge synthesizer studio. I'm thinking of one of my favorite synth guys, Larry Fast. Did you ever listen
to him? Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
out of New Jersey. Really fantastic. And some people were saying, you know, that this kind of is evoking Vangelis. I'm looking through the chat room here, a couple of stuff that, you know, it's very ambient. And I have to tell you, I have listened to this on a 5.1 system, and I think your mixing is very effective. You're really moving things around and placing things in a way that is very immersive, very integrated. As long as you're sitting in the sweet spot. Now, let me ask you about that, because 2.0, two-channel music, basically you have a sweet line, shall we say, right down the middle of the speakers, and you can be closer or farther from them within certain parameters and get the stereo sound image. But in a 5.1, you really have a sweet spot, one place that is puts you more or less equidistant from all the speakers. Do you think that's a limitation that, you've explained why you want to do it. You want to do 5.1 because of the immersive quality of it, but is it more limiting in that way?
Well, there's some challenges. I mean, that's one of the difficulties in anticipating all the variables in people's systems and base management and the way that these receivers deal with LFE information. I mean, I have a dedicated LFE, and
that was one question I was going to ask you, was did you put much in the LFE, the low frequency effects channel, the 0.1 channel?
I abused the hell out of it. You know what I mean? Some people feel like, some people feel like it's reserved for low booms and, you know, UB, whatever that movie, the submarine movie, where you heard all that subsonic information on there. But I really feel like I want to hear an extension of the Moog bass and some kick drum and other elements that obviously, you know, are could be effective in that frequency range. But the challenge is that when you are mixing this material, obviously you can't anticipate what all the variables in people's systems are. So you have to just kind of make it sound good in your room and hope that translates. And I think that is one of the challenges. But what I do love about this notion of having to be in the sweet spot is that it really forces one to sit down and listen to music, which I think is a wonderful thing to do. And I provided some visuals here to make this kind of immersive visually, from almost going back to like the Griffith Park Laserium.
I remember the Griffith Park Laserium. I used to go in high school.
I know. Yeah. So, you know, there's a little bit of that in there, but this notion of sitting down and listening to music, I'm a big fan of. And if that's what 5.1 helps people do to stay in the sweet spot, then I'm all for it. You know, put down the devices and just zone out for a minute.
Or an hour.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. So, you know, there's no argument for me. I like to listen to music and be in the center of I live in the sweet spot. So, you know. You know?
Well, certainly, you know, music has become much more of a background to our life rather than something that we sit down and listen to and do nothing else. And so you're encouraging people to do that, which I think is a really good thing.
Absolutely. I'm trying to fight that fight. And look, I have a whole career, you know, in providing a music that is serving picture. And it's a subordinate use, right? I mean, it's a secondary kind of to what's going on. It's serving the picture. And and that's a wonderful thing. But it also informs my compositions as well, in that I'm trying to evoke, you know, there is a kind of cinematic quality, some of the stuff, and I don't do that intentionally. It just seems to come out that way. And I think that, you know, you don't necessarily always need talking over music to be able to hear it, you know.
Yeah, but you're
absolutely right. And that's something that's been going on for a while is that music is it's ubiquitous, right? It's everywhere. It's you go to the restaurant, you go down, you know, everywhere, the mall and it's
or even on your own system, you know, your own little player and earbuds or whatever, but it's while you're doing something else.
Absolutely. But one could also make the argument that music is more important than ever because it is everywhere. And it means that it's obviously functioning in a way that it's something that people want, right?
Mm, no doubt.
And I think that is the power of it. And if we can get back to this, and that's what I love about this community of home theater people and high-end systems is this getting back to a place where you know, there's a respect for and a reverence for the way that things are recorded, performed, and produced, and all of that stuff, which is kind of a something of a bygone era, I would say. You know, but
a number of people in the chat room actually are likening your music to Tangerine Dream, another group that I have loved for decades. So you're getting some good feedback here from the chat room, which is great.
Some interesting association there. Yeah, I think they had quite a run of movies and kind of cinematic scores that they created back in really the beginning of when all this started, which was the synth kind of based scores, and they did it very effectively. So that's it's nice
now,
to
one
hear.
Thing I wanted to ask you. Well, first of all, a couple things. One is, how are the graphics generated? And I must tell you, I was listening to this while watching the graphics on the new Sony A1E OLED. And oh my God, does that look great?
Yeah, they're marvelous. They really are.
I mean, man,
Mark,
so how did
Mark
you, how
did a wonderful how, job of that?
Did Mark do that?
Mark did the graphic package for the whole thing, and that was actually his suggestion, which I thought was wonderful because I had actually suggested doing some videos, and I was interested in having kind of this visual component along with the music. And he suggested this kind of frequency and amplitude kind of triggering software that would. I gave him some stems of the various parts, you know, the breakdowns of the mix, be it the drums or the bass or some kind of pulsing rhythmic thing. And he would put those into the software, and that would the software would respond with shapes and images based on the frequencies and amplitude of those audio files. And
which I love. I love that.
Yeah. That's really kind of trippy, isn't it? You just kind of sit there and watch that stuff. I really like that aspect of this project a lot.
Well done, Mark. Really, really very good.
Absolutely.
And speaking of the stems, we have a couple of shots of did you mix this in Pro Tools?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so we got a couple of shots of Pro Tools of the project. One is called Stems, and that shows us sort of what you're talking about there. Tell us just a little bit about this image here.
Well, it's considered kind of a common practice now to break out the various elements of your mix in subgroups. And what you have there is piano, percussion, drums, pulses, ambience, you know, just various categories that I've been working with for years. And it's basically something so that if I ever want to recreate the mix, or perhaps it's used in a way that somebody might want to manipulate one sound that might be conflicting with something or omit something, it's a lot easier to do that. So with all my mixes, I create stems as well as the stereo file. And basically that's achieved by creating solo groups in the software and making sure that all the members of that category that I've created are in the particular group. So I do them one at a time for 5-1. Usually if I'm in stereo, I have another way of doing it so I can print those all at the same time. I only have one 5-1 bus on my analog 5-1 console. So that's why I have to do those one at a time. But it's effective for, you know, just a lot of reasons, being able to recreate it and having options later.
Right. And then we have some more detail. We have one called Piano and Drums, which is, I guess, zooming into just looking at the piano and drums. And this actually brings up another question that I want you to address, which is the music on this album is what you've called electroacoustic, in which you combine the synthesizer sounds that we were talking about earlier with actual acoustic recordings of acoustic instruments.
Correct.
So why did you do that? Why did you decide to make that combination? What's important about adding acoustic instruments to electronic or vice versa?
Well, I just think that I love acoustic instruments, and I love the fusion of, you know, and I love electronics and synths and whatnot. And I'm just fascinated by fusing those two and creating a hybrid. I'm a drummer, I'm a piano player. So naturally it seems like a good idea to me, and I like the results. I like hearing that the complex harmonics of a piano juxtaposed against this kind of rigid, kind of metronomic, sequence that might be going on, in any piece. And I think that it leads to some interesting results. And that's what I'm chasing a lot. I'm actually thinking about even going further with that and maybe doing some stuff with sequences of this ilk and getting more orchestral elements in there and seeing, experimenting with that. So it's just kind of a pulling of the thread a little bit for me. I love the recording process, obviously, of recording live instruments. And it's certainly a challenge to make them as immediate. You know, these synths have a lot of transients and they're right in your face, right? And so to get the drums, the acoustic drums or whatnot, to actually sit in their property and perform the function I want them to do takes a bit of sculpting and stuff. And that's also an interesting challenge.
Here we're looking at a picture of Pro Tools with just the piano and drum tracks. Is that correct?
Yeah, this is just to kind of illustrate the basic template that I have. Since I record and play everything myself, I have to start out with a basic kind of template that has a baseline of what I think I might be, composing in any given track. So it has the options of, all these groups, as I said, the stem groups, right? And the colors represent these different groups. You have green there for the piano and then blue. And then below that, there's a number of tracks. I probably have, 80 tracks in the session. And that just kind of shows the blank template as I start and how I start to record inside of Pro Tools. You can see on the top, there's a 5-1 mix. And for every 5-1 mix I do, I also am making a stereo mix. And so that's directly below it. The stereo mix will be contained in the next set of tracks there. So this one didn't have that. But that's also a challenge, is down mixing it and kind of keeping, kind of the same. It's tough to do with some of the density that goes on in the 5-1. Once you start producing music in 5-1, it's once you leave that realm, it's hard to get it to translate sometimes. But I've been getting better at that,
Well, that is the next question is what do you think about? What do you need to consider when I assume that you create a your own two-channel mix as opposed to letting the player, say the Blu-ray player, just do the down mix automatically? I'm sure you need some creative control over that, right?
Absolutely. And I apply, kind of some compression over the two mix and sometimes some EQ and whatnot. But getting everything to cohabitate in the stereo field, from because I start this stuff in 5-1 and start to do what we talked about earlier, which is moving stuff around and kind of swirling and going panning and, using the center speaker and, using little spotlights. And I've actually found that mono is really an interesting recording process for 5-1, because it allows you to kind of shine a light in any one of these speakers and kind of highlight something, which is really cool. I've been enjoying the mono thing. But when it comes down to down mixing it, Yeah, it's been the more I do it, the easier it's been getting. And in terms of getting the results that I'm looking for and creating parity between the two, obviously, without an LFE channel, I don't have a sub on my stereo speakers on my mains here. So the bass doesn't feel like it goes down as far. There's much weight, as much weight in the stereo. But but I try to compensate with that with maybe some level differences and just kind of finessing it and massaging the mix to make it translate. And that's kind of part of the whole thing, you know?
Right. Now, on this CD, or Blu-ray rather, there is another option, which I found fascinating, and that is a binaural recording to be listened to on headphones. And this actually gives you the 5.1 mix without actually playing the 5.1 mix. It's we've talked about it on this show before, binaural recording.
Right.
And you created it in, I think, a really amazing and interesting way. Tell us about it.
Well, that was another benefit of the Blu-ray platform, that we could have multiple kind of audio files that were all synchronized. So you can actually, in real time, you know, using the Blu-ray player, go between the stereo mix and the 5.1 mix, or the Blu-ray, or the binaural mix, which is really interesting. Probably the most interesting difference is between the stereo mix from the board and the binaural mix, because the spatial thing that happens when you capture the binaural mix is absolutely fascinating. And I actually, in some ways, prefer it because it just has an openness. It's not quite as immediate and punchy, but it is deeper. And in that way, it's really cool. You can kind of look into the mix a little bit. I have a microphone that was intended to capture. It's shaped like a human head. And I guess Neumann had done a lot of research and created this microphone that that simulates the human, hearing capabilities. And
at least the outer trappings of the human hearing capabilities.
Well,
we have a photo of it called the dummy head. So we're going to take a look at that.
Right.
And there you are with the Neumann KU100, I believe, is the model number of it.
That's exactly right. So during the whole video process on this, Mark and I were talking, and Mark actually suggested, hey, why don't you put up that mic in your listening position in the sweet spot in the center of the room and capture the 5.1 mixes using the binaural head? And I said, hey, that's super cool. That's just kind of a value-added thing to put on the disc, and it's interesting from a comparison standpoint, as I said earlier. It's really quite cool. I think it's something, again, that's not really readily available out there, and although binaural stuff has been around for a while, and I think there's different discs out there, but it's not really prevalent, right? We don't have a lot of...
I studied it in college when I was a physics major. I spent a lot of time in studying psychoacoustics, and binaural recording was part of that. But what I found so interesting about your approach was you took that binaural recording head, which has microphones in simulated ears,
right?
Stuck it in your listening position in your studio,
right?
Played the 5.1 mix, basically,
exactly.
And it went from digital to analog. Analog into these little microphones in the ears,
right.
Turning it back into an analog signal, I guess, or
right.
And at some point then redigitizing it, such that when you listen to that mix on headphones, you hear the 5.1 mix. I don't
you,
think
you
I've ever heard anybody.
Hear it, yes. Yeah,
yeah. I don't think I'd ever heard any, and you hear it on the system in your studio.
Absolutely, you do, and
so
that's
whatever those speakers are. By the way, what speakers do you have in that studio?
I have ATC 200s.
Common professional speaker, really nice.
Absolutely. Beautiful. We're pushing some air around here.
Yeah. So then you're not only listening to the 5.1 mix you're not listening to it on your system at home. You're listening to John Keane's system in his studio.
Absolutely, and. It was fascinating because by and large, I really liked the way that it sounded. There was a little bit of multiband, frequency compression that I did and kind of the lower mids where I felt like the LFE and whatnot, you know, it was kind of building up a little bit, you know, because there was a lot of information down there. So I did a little trimming in that area. I think it was somewhere around there, but I remember there was a little bit of murkiness that I wanted to kind of carve out a little bit, but I didn't do anything else to it, just to maybe cut you know, a dB or two and at certain frequencies in the low end. So it's interesting. I'd be curious. I haven't really heard from many people that if they've actually listened and compared it with some critical listening. So it'd be interesting to hear what people's thoughts.
I intend to, for sure.
Cool.
Got a couple of questions from the chat room relating back to your family. Good Sound is asking, are you related to John K. Keane, who was a mixer at Universal in the 60s and 70s?
No, but the older I get, there's more Keens that show up. I'm not aware. There was also a Bill Keane that was a cartoonist, and I think he was in the LA Times for years. So no, I'm not related to him, but your
dad was a producer in the business.
Absolutely, and as a matter of fact, once the whole run had ended for various reasons, which I'm kind of unclear on why his record career ended, but you know, it was tough back then, the record industry. He had some success. The artist eventually, you know, met a very sad end. Obviously, we know the story of Ritchie Valens and the airplane. And then Bobby Fuller was also was killed here in Hollywood, which is kind of a Hollywood murder mystery that has never really been told. But he had some bad luck in there. But he also made a lot of surf records. And apparently, during the 60s, I mean, he just made a ton of this stuff, like Dick Dale kind of stuff. And once he finally got his masters back in the 80s, it was kind of this very fortuitous, strange kind of thing that happened where somebody called him and said, hey, I got some tapes here. And he was kind of back in business. He actually provided a lot of the music to Pulp Fiction, where they didn't want to pay for maybe the more expensive surf music. So he had a whole catalog of stuff of the day that actually came back and was relevant, like, you know, 30 years later, which is pretty cool, you know.
Wow, that is really cool.
So you never know when you're recording stuff, you know. It's you know,
who knows, right? UJ in the chat, actually Mark Waldrop is in the chat room, so hey Mark, glad to see you're here.
Kick him out of there.
No, he's more than welcome. UJ is asking Mark, and one thing I wanted to ask you about was, okay, so you've got 5.1. What about doing music in Atmos, Dolby Atmos, or DTS:X, or Oro 3D, of which we have some examples, wherein you have not only sound around you, but overhead as well. Is that something you're interested in experimenting with?
Yeah, I think to date, you can encode it. I know the Pro Tools latest release is allowing for, they have some kind of, down mixing thing. I mean, there's not many people or many studios that I know of that have that capability. So it would probably be pretty hard to figure out exactly what you're getting unless you were working in that environment. I did hear a demonstration at the Los Angeles Audio Show down at the Sheraton, and it was absolutely fascinating. I mean, but it was a movie, and you know, I'm not sure.
Exactly. Mostly it's being used for movie soundtracks.
Right, exactly. And for that, I mean, it's incredible with all of the subsonic information and the rumbling and the, you know, the gunfire and stuff just kind of being moved all around. But it's hard to know. I mean, it's like we talked about, you know, options are the enemy of commitment. I mean, it's hard to imagine how that would benefit almost dilute elements in a way. If they were moving around so much, you couldn't get a real focus on things. But I'll kind of reserve judgment until I actually get to do it. But it just theoretically, it's it is interesting, but I just don't know how it would work with just a music-only disc in Atmos.
Yeah. Well, I don't know either. It would be an experiment for sure. I love when you and I were talking before the show, we were talking about how 5.1 gives you a great deal of freedom, which you have used to place instruments in unusual ways and so on, but that perhaps adding the overhead element might be too much freedom, that, it, as you say, dilutes creativity in a sense.
Yeah, well, that focus of like how is it supposed to fit into everything else when there's all these things moving around, but it could be cool to compose something in that natively, and that would inform, I guess, your production as well, right? You would actually play to the strengths of something like that, and maybe write something that would be compelling while using it, and that's another way of approaching it, right? One of my approaches, I think, in doing this is I have a unique approach because I spend a lot of time on dub stages with mixers mixing media. And so when I approached this project, I kind of took some of that thinking and those approaches where you're moving stuff around in the same way that you would move elements from, say, a Foley mix or a special effects track or something like that. And I thought to myself, well, why can't you do that with just music and, you know, use that center speaker to isolate a mono drum loop or an ostinato or something like that, because a lot of people are conflicted about what the center speaker is actually good for, and I actually found a good use for it in a number of things, and I've actually come to embrace the center speaker for certain things. So,
musically, you mean? Because certainly that's where the dialogue occurs.
Absolutely, normally it does. Yeah, and I listen to a record like Yellow Brick Road and soloed the various locations, and Elton's vocal is like right in the center speaker, which I was actually, it's completely isolated in the center speaker, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. I mean, obviously there was 5-1 verb throughout the other speakers, but for instrumental music, it's different because I'm not dealing with a vocal and whatnot. So I find these various musical elements that I feel like fit in the center speaker, and I feel like I've found some interesting uses for it. So,
Buckmaster in the chat room is saying there's a new Kraftwerk live 3D Blu-ray with Dolby Atmos track and a two channel headphone binaural track.
Wow!
Now, if that's a live, I haven't heard of that one before. But if it's a live broadcast like recording, then that Atmos makes some sense because you presumably have ambience.
Right.
And presumably you're more or less in the audience looking at the stage and they're performing.
Right. That's a great point, Scott. I think that's probably one of the best uses for Atmos, you know.
I know that Mark in many of his live recordings will offer you the option of the audience perspective, right, where you're in the audience and you're looking at the stage and most of the sounds coming from in front of you and the overhead or the surrounds anyway are being used for ambience, or you can have what he calls the stage perspective, which is you're sitting in the middle of the orchestra or the ensemble, whatever it is, and you've got everything all around you, in which case it might be interesting to again in that case use the overheads as if you were sitting on the stage and you're hearing reflections from overhead or whatever. It's all very open and new.
What you want to present it. And, but it's an interesting point because I still feel like when I'm capturing sounds, you know, microphones don't necessarily sound like what I hear. I think that when I go to a concert at Disney Hall and I listen to music, and I listen to a recording of it, there's a difference between what I hear in the hall and the recording that was made. And I think that's still a very important distinction to make that, the human ear is far more capable of absorbing all of those things at once that you just talked about versus the isolation of those individual things that are very interesting to offer to people. But I still am of the opinion that that stuff does sound different to me than is captured in microphones. And
That's absolutely true. Microphones and ears are not the same thing.
No, they're not. They're not. But it's great for me because I love produced music. I like to produce music, and I use microphone techniques to actually achieve a result that I'm looking for. And it's not always the purity of the signal or capturing it, it's how it functions and how I want it to function and what part it's playing, and that has to do with the whole sound sculpting and shaping and the decision making process of producing music, which is just endless. You know, love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Mark Waldrop in the chat room actually is reminding us that Morten Lindberg of 2L in Norway, which is a record label in Norway, uses Atmos for some of his recordings. And I think he also did, if it wasn't him, it was somebody else at 2L, I think. I might be wrong about that, who recorded a choral piece in Norway, I think, in Oro 3D, which is another immersive sound format. And right. I've heard that recording several times, and it's wow. So, you know, there's something to be said for doing some of that experimentation, for sure.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And you're obviously an experimentalist, so it's something worth thinking about. Regarding high-res audio, somebody in the chat room earlier, and I wouldn't be able to find it right now, wondered about DSD, which is the digital audio format that's used on the disc format called SACD, and you can also download stuff. I think 2L is one place where you can download that. I know that Mark prefers PCM, which is what you used here, 96 kilohertz, 24 bits, which is greater than CD quality, so to speak. But it's different than DSD. Have you ever thought about recording in DSD, or what are your thoughts about it?
Again, you know, it's something that, this being my first 5.1 project, you know, I suppose there's something there, but I haven't really considered it thus far. And
The editing tools are more difficult to, and you know, there aren't as many, and in many cases, people who record to DSD convert to PCM in order to do their editing and mixing and so on, and then maybe reconvert it back to DSD at the end. So it's a more complicated thing. I just wondered if you had any particular thoughts on it.
Well, you know, all algorithms are not created equal in that, you know, there's some software that doesn't sound as good as other software when it makes the PCM encoding as well. And so I think we know that. And it's all at the user's discretion, I guess, when you find those tools that work for you and make it sound the way that you want it to sound. And if that's the format, it's hard to think about something. I try to think about, you know, making interesting, evocative music, and the format kind of, I think, will be born out of that, you know, at later stages. But, we'll see. Maybe in the future I'll do something with that.
Yeah. So what do you see as the benefit of high-res audio, talking about that now? 96 kilohertz, 24 bits gives you greater dynamic range, greater frequency range that you can capture, but it's in many cases it's beyond what humans can perceive. So I always ask this of musicians: what is the benefit that you see to high res audio?
Well, it's like it's kind of like that idea of paranoia. You know, just because you can't see them doesn't mean they're not there. There's actually benefits that maybe we're not completely cognizant of, and I would
conscious of, shall we say.
What's that?
I say conscious of.
Yeah, conscious of. Yeah, yeah.
That's... It may not be. There may be some subconscious effect. I've heard many people say that, you know, you may not be able to hear those ultrasonics or hear, you know, a 100 and whatever. Mark in the chat room will be able to tell me what the dynamic range of 24 bits is. Theoretically, I think it's like 144 dB, whereas CDs are like 90 six, theoretically, more like 92 or three, practically speaking.
Right.
But 90 dB is so much more dynamic range, certainly than
absolutely.
Most pop recordings. Let me ask you this. Did you utilize the full dynamic range of 24 bits in this recording?
Oh, absolutely. I tried as best I could to do that. And I think that there's no dispute, really, that 96, 24 sounds better. The question is that... does convenience trump quality? And I think that
the perennial question. Yes.
Well, of course, but the notion that you know we're here talking about this, I think, is great because it's kind of this idea of audio literacy where were promoting kind of, you know, critical listening. And I guarantee that if I played, a 44.1 file to somebody that maybe didn't have as educated an ear and played, a piano, you know, we're talking about acoustic instruments, not samples here, but actually something that has complex harmonics, that they would be able to tell the difference in clarity and depth and dynamic range and all of that stuff. I think it's that self-evident. But, you know, those are using some pretty advanced, high-quality tools as well as the monitors and all that stuff. But
sure. You got to have the playback. You got to have the playback equipment to render that high-resolution audio in such a way.
Absolutely. Right. But it's the fact that, you know, critical listening is also a developed skill. And I love that this community is very, very interested in and pursuing this kind of, you know, it's fascinating to make these comparisons, you know, when we talk about the binaural versus the coming off the stereo bus of the console. And because that really informs and deepens your knowledge base and your information about what it is that you like and the differences of what you can hear versus, and it helps to develop your ear, you know, it really does. And I'm a big fan of that. Just kind of developing and hearing the different subtle differences in a lot of this stuff. But to my ear, 9624 is not a subtle difference. I just think that
even compared with uncompressed CD 44.1 16-bit.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And that's because I'm in my studio recording, the complex harmonics of a piano, which is really, really, deep in terms of all of the harmonics that are going on, and the level of detail on something like that. Now, will you hear that on a sampled kick drum with, sampled bongos and a Rhodes that's coming out of software? I don't think there's a benefit there, but to the human voice, to acoustic instruments and capturing that, I think that there's huge advantages there. And I think it's just kind of getting people to realize that this is just a higher quality, and if they heard it, I think they would agree. But
yeah, Hamid in the chat room is saying, I also hear more naturalness to HD audio and more spaciousness.
Right, that's very true, because that stuff can get peaky, and we start to see, these artifacts, and that's a lot of what's happening in MP3s. Is it's introducing these distortion artifacts and whatnot, and that's not something I can really get used to, I don't want to hear that stuff. So I can't really listen to MP3s myself, but you're absolutely right.
There is a more natural.
Yeah, that's a well put. It is more natural to I think, record at those higher sample rates and bit rates,
Speaking of recording pianos, I just wanted to make sure we showed this picture of your actual recording of a piano. And that's a pretty complex thing. Just that one thing out of all that you did, putting microphones on a giant thing like a piano to capture it well is an art unto itself.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, like everything else, Scott, I've kind of I'm very detail oriented in what I'm doing, and so I've for my room, those mics are pretty close to the soundboard there, but a lot of times in classical recordings, you'll see that stuff, moved back. And I prefer the way that I want to hear it in my music, the piano represented in my music is that there's immediacy to it. And this miking technique offers that. There's something you can't see at the very end there. There's an R44, AEA microphone, which is wonderful. It's like the old kind of RCA microphone. It's hanging at the very base there. And I put that out of phase, and it just fills out the bottom end. I flip the phase on it, so there's a slight time difference there. And it's really a beautiful, beautiful sound. And, I've experimented with moving those mics all around, and that's where I kind of ended up having it sound really good there, is at the hammers there and kind of halfway in. Parallel with the strings, and those are M149 microphones, which make just about anything sound real good.
Miking drums is another art in unto itself, and we have a picture of that as well. I want to show everybody that you put mics all over the place. Are you generally a fan of close miking?
Well, that's an interesting point. Well, you see that 251 that's hanging over the ride symbol there. Yeah. That's actually not part of the miking. I use that as a mono mic, and I found that location to sound really good in my room where I can actually get some kick drum and get the snare, and it's a really good balance of the kick there. So that's used for like a mono miking. And to get some of that immediacy I talked about earlier with these electronic elements, I feel like, yes, there is a benefit to some close miking, but it's not right for everything. In this picture, you don't see that there's actually some mics in the room there, and I actually have some other kind of configurations, stereo configurations that I capture the room in, so I can get more of an ambient sound.
I actually see the dummy head in the back there too.
Well, that's a beautiful thing on the, you know, I'm not so much using it as a binaural mic in that instance because I'm combining it with these close mics, but it sounds wonderful on the drum overheads because it's not peaky. And a lot of times on these recordings on the Blu-ray, there's not a lot of cymbals on there. There's some cymbals, but not a lot. And I'm always very careful to try to control those frequencies against the piano and the higher end because I feel like they conflict. And that KU-100 is so kind of nice and mellow that when you are using cymbals with it, it's really a warm kind of overhead drum sound. I love it. Love it.
Mm. So I assume, last question here, I assume that you would like to see more surround music that it was mixed in this way, come out. There isn't very much of it. There's some.
Yeah, it's true.
But there isn't. Why do you suppose there isn't more? Is it because most people don't have a 5.1 system to play it back on? I'm just curious, why do you suppose?
Well, that, you know, it's funny. I'm sorry, go ahead.
That there isn't more of it out there now.
A longtime engineer friend of mine, Wynn Davis, you know, said years ago, he goes, you got to get into 5.1. You got to start doing this stuff. And, it's like audio crack. And, you know, he's so right, because once you start working, it's like, you know, you're preaching to the choir. I mean, it's so cool that I can't believe it didn't catch on. But yeah. The other aspect of it is that I guess there is this kind of, you know, investment that you have to make, and you have to have five, you know, speakers and plus the one and the sub. And so I kind of get it from that perspective. But once you start listening to stuff in 5.1, I just feel like it's really, really cool. And yeah, there are times when I can't believe that it didn't catch on. But, you know, I'm doing my part to try to you know, carry the torch here and bring it, you know, make an instrumental electronic album with organic elements on it in Blu-ray is pretty rarefied air. But, you know, I'm doing it, you know. So
well,
hopefully,
and good on you.
Yeah, and you too, Scott. I mean, you're fighting the good fight too. We love that.
Well, I love it myself, and so I like to make sure people know about it right. And experience it for themselves and make their own decision. You know, maybe they won't like it, but I really do. And
it's fascinating because I think if you approach it, a lot of the material that I hear out there now is almost like fill. Like they've taken it as a secondary format and taken stereo material and filled it into the 5.1. Not everything.
Oh, kind of expanded it synthetically almost.
Yes. Right. So they're just filling the surrounds and stuff like that. You know, when you actually record something from the ground up, you're actually afforded all of this cool stuff in terms of, you know, putting this music in locations and moving it around and highlighting stuff. And that's where it gets interesting to me is actually music produced for 5.1 in 5.1 and 7.1. I don't know. I haven't really worked in that.
That's your next frontier there, huh?
Yeah, maybe there is. I got another set of speakers in my future.
Well, John, thank you so much for being here. It's been a fascinating conversation. And your music is wonderful. And I do encourage people to go check it out. And you can get it at your website, jmksonics.com, where you can hear snippets, clips from the other tracks and learn more about what John is doing. John, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Scott. It's been a pleasure.
Good, good, good. For me too. So again, John's website is jmksonics.com. You can always find me at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/HTG and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/HomeTheaterGeeks. Next week, I'm going to have a whole raft of guest geeks. A bunch of people went to the recent QLED and HDR10 summit last week. And so I will be joined by Joe Kane, Jeff Tully, and Ron Williams to talk about everything that we saw and heard and learned at this summit, which was very interesting and very geeky. So get ready to put your propeller hat on, because that's going to be one hell of a ride. Until then, geek out.